Okay, Gender of Energy 84, Georgi Dinkov, how are you, sir? What's new in your life?
Well, I don't know what's new in my life. It's pretty much the same as before. I've been watching the economic news lately. I don't know if you've been following him too.
A little bit.
Yeah. And then you just sent me that thing, the Telegram post, about basically the Fed. All this talk about the Fed planning to have a digital currency, releasing a white paper, all of this is smokescreen. They're actually ready to go now. And I think that Powell said that basically the Fed now, which is, I guess, this will be the platform behind the digital dollar, is going to go live on February 2023. So they've been ready, I think, for some time. And of course, I responded back to email saying, like, how is Powell justifying his statement that moving the dollar towards, you know, full digitization? How is it going to improve its standing, you know, around the world and, you know, remaining a reserve currency? I mean, you know, if other countries are trying to de-dollarize, they don't care if you're using digital or paper dollar. They're just not going to use it, right? So I think it's just you know, just a smokescreen again for the fact that they're going to introduce the digital currency ready already, you know, basically in 2023, and that's it. There will be no debate. There'll be no public comments. There's no white paper. There is a white paper, but the white paper is kind of announcing that they've already done it.
So I know nothing about economics or finance or anything, but somebody was like, "How does it making the currency digital bring us out of the trillions of debt?" And this person, who I have...
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I had the same question.
Okay, and they say, it mitigates the 7% remittance costs, fees of $14 trillion in Nostro accounts, and settles through DIT bridges instantly. That's how? Does that make any sense whatsoever?
So the 7% that we're going to save, that's basically going to... Look, the inflation was 7% in 1 month alone. So I think this is laughable. I don't see how this actually improves things because it's still the same dollar. The problem isn't the digitization or the paperization. The fact is there's too much printed money in circulation, mm-hmm. chasing too few assets. Mm-hmm. And having a digital dollar, well, I guess they may do a default. They may do a basically, currency devaluation. If they do that, then I don't know, maybe it can be more easily done with the digital dollar. The point is, as it stands now, switching simply over to the fully digital does absolutely nothing to improve the economic situation. The only thing it may do is basically the Fed will basically say, now every citizen has an account, right? And then we're going to be giving you stimulus checks into that account. And once people get used to it after a year or two, then they're going to introduce the actual social credit system tied to it. And then we're going to start seeing things like, well, bzz, you can't spend this here, or like you've bought too much of this there. And that's pretty much it. I haven't heard anybody explain how having a digital currency resolves the debt issue, the inflation issue, or the fact that the Western countries are no longer industrial economies. They're all so-called knowledge economies, which is just another euphemism for a house of cards.
There's a line here. Yeah, that's it really seems like game over when that is employed in some way, shape, or form, because you really can't do anything after that. And the other thing is we've been speculating, at least over a year of how they were going to introduce this, and I wouldn't have guessed. It would have just been so like, oh, here it is now. You know, like... I wonder if they'll tie it into blackouts or energy drops, because that's really dominating the news cycle right now. And so
I don't think they care, to be honest with you. I don't think they even plan on doing tricks and smoke and mirrors. They feel so confident, and it's so far advanced in the game has progressed so much that now there's no time for all of this, right? Basically they'll introduce it and say this is how it's going to be, and that's about it. What I'm more afraid of is that they may cancel the elections in November, and basically say, like, I don't know, come up with something, food shortages, power blackouts, whatnot, basically. And once they say no more elections, then any remaining pretense of democracy is gone, and then they can do whatever they want. There's no need to explain why introducing a digital currency. You're just saying that's what we're doing, and you guys are going to follow it.
Yeah. Scary times. And then anything in D.C., any noticeable changes or anything?
The housing prices have started to decline, which is almost unheard of for DC, especially certain areas of DC, the more affluent ones. And basically, what else? gas is very expensive. The price of used cars have started to drop, which was another thing that, at least in DC, was people thought that it could never happen. Mm-hmm. So what else? I'm seeing more people move out of DC, mm-hmm. especially people with children. Mm-hmm. We're getting notices all the time from the public school where my kids go that, you know, such and such family has been here for, like, I don't know, 8-10 years in DC, and now they're moving across the river to Virginia or, like, you know, a couple of miles north into Maryland. And this, I got 7 such emails from the beginning of the year. So even though there's no more lockdown and, you know, there's no vaccine mandates, at least in DC, I mean, they've suspended them for now. Basically, the exodus continues. The crime wave is huge. DC is set to set a new record in violent crime for the last 20 years. I think that this year, if it continues that way, will be the most violent that DC has seen in the last 20 years. Other than that, I guess everything is. It looks okay, but you can sense there's this tension in the air.
Yeah.
Especially once the economy starts, you know. Having problems and people start getting laid off. Even in DC, you can sense that things are not calm. So we'll see. But
did you see that like Metro DC poster that it was like a white guy yelling at a trans person? And it was like, if you see this, report it. And then somebody tweeted, it's like, I don't think those are reflect the real problems of the DC Metro. Like, that's like the worst thing that's going to happen is like a white guy yelling at a trans woman, or like, I don't know what it was supposed to be, but like, it was,
But look at the ad. The ad is already stereotypical. Probably a white guy with a MAGA hat yelling at a trans person of color.
But like, yeah. In San Francisco, the BART system, it's like if you were on a train that like that somebody hadn't defecated on, you were like doing pretty well, like because that was such a common occurrence, or somebody jerking off on the car or something, like the most disgusting stuff you could possibly imagine.
You know, did you see the article in the Atlantic? I didn't expect to see it in the Atlantic. It said how San Francisco became a failed city.
Oh, right.
It was their front page article from like.
I've been
a couple
saying
days
that
ago.
For years.
Yeah. It's such a surreal world. Like back in the late 90s, when I first came from Bulgaria to the United States, like when you talk to Americans that have been to Bulgaria, they always thought it was a surreal situation because the 90s were basically what the U.S. is starting to look like right now. Mm-hmm. Extreme polarization. Basically, everybody's poor except for like the mafia guys who were driving around in their Mercedes and BMWs. And you basically have junkies rolling on the street and like shooting drugs and like robbing each other and fighting and whatnot. And now this exact same situation, you can see it in pretty much every large coastal U.S. city. So it's really, I don't know, it does not portend well for the coastal areas of the United States. But you're insulated from that, right? Or are you considering a comeback or no?
Did you say, am I considering coming back?
Yeah, come back to the United States. Or is this like make you laugh?
Makes me laugh, I think. Dude, I like have property now, basically. And so have we talked since I moved? Maybe, I think we have at least one time, but this is so embarrassing because I've been working on this chicken coop for like 6 months now, but I'm this close to fully finishing the chicken coop because we moved it here and then I rebuilt the run and did a lot of like upgrades to it. And so that's almost finished. It just needs to put a chicken in it. And then I'm like dabbling in the tree stuff. But I mean, if you think there are different perspectives on physiology, there are lots of different perspectives on how to grow a tree. And
oh,
so,
yeah, of course. Yeah. And is the Mexicana helping?
See, she's helping. She knows a thing or two about growing. And then I guess the trees, I think, can fail or take years to produce fruit. But I think we want to do goats next, and because we have enough space to easily do that. But again, all this stuff is new to me, and it's kind of flying by the seat of my pants, and we'll see what happens when. The annoying thing about Mexico is, at least for me, it's like, oh, you want a guava tree? Talk to this guy, and then he'll tell you to talk to this guy, and then you'll talk to this guy to get it. And whereas, like, if I was in the U.S., there's a website called Sow Exotic, which sells fruit trees, and you just buy them, and they'll ship a longan tree to your house. And yeah. I'd go like nuts on this website. If I had land in the US or something, you could get a Wanabana tree sent to your house, like exotic, really cool trees that are like not like you can't find anywhere. And I actually emailed them about shipping a tree to Mexico, and they're like, "Are you insane? It's going to die." Like, who?
That and people probably chop it up and break it and doing transportation, and it's going to make it to you, but it will be in a state of pulp.
Yeah, but I'm almost considering ordering one just to see how it, like, what happens to it, because if I could make this website work, I don't like things that take away my autonomy of doing things. And so talking to a guy. It's hard for me to wrap my head around, and so
yeah.
Anyways,
speaking of Mexico, several women on the forum have expressed interest in you. So if things don't work out with a Mexican girl, I'll send you the thread. One of them is a former model. That she's the one who basically said, "I'm actually surprised Dan is still single. He's actually rather cute."
Okay, we'll just go ahead and edit this out, this part of this
podcast. Why?
I'm just joking. That's very flattering. Thank you very much, Repeat Forum women. That's very, very nice of you ladies. In other news, okay, is there anything else we have to talk about before we move on?
I don't know. I mean, we launched the steroids, so we can talk about it later.
We'll talk about that. We'll definitely set aside time for that. Okay, let's just get straight into it. Oh, you know what? Ray Pete will be back on the show next Friday. And so that was – we had some miscommunication, and so we finally connected, and he'll be back on the show on Friday. Okay, so let's jump right into it. What was the serotonin one, the most popular article?
Yeah, I think that was – if you look at my Twitter feed, that's the one that got like retweeted up to the wazoo.
Yeah.
I mean, all of this stuff is stuff we've talked about for years, but I, you know, it was surprising for me to see it in a fairly mainstream press article. If you scroll down, I think the website is basically it's you know, you wouldn't expect to see the Psychology Today. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Psychology Today is like the bastion of mainstream psychiatry. Like if you whatever article you see there, you expect them to praise the SSRIs, which they do kind of even in this article. That basically serotonin is the cure for depression, right? Dopamine is a problem, causes psychosis. Dopamine antagonists are great, et cetera, et cetera. Suddenly, this article, which basically says that there is a massive, apparently, even among the doctors, they know that there is a massive increase in serotonin, in the baseline levels of serotonin in depressed patients. And somehow they're saying that when you take SSRI drugs, when basically they increase the serotonin even more, somehow that triggers your body to start producing less serotonin because it thinks now you have too much. Whether that's true or not, I think it's kind of beside the point, because if your serotonin is already high and you raise it even more with the SSRI drugs, that's a very well-known trigger of suicide. Yeah. In fact, the autopsies that have been done on people who committed suicide show that they have a very high levels of the serotonin metabolite, 5-hydroxyindole acetic acid in their cerebrospinal fluid. You can have high levels of that unless you also have very high levels of serotonin, right? Because it cannot be synthesized through another pathway. And they're saying, so to me, the first shocking thing is they admitted that serotonin is actually high in depression, not low. Then immediately provided a fraudulent explanation of why the SSRI drugs work, somehow by raising it more. And then basically, I guess they're turning full Blake here. They're saying, you never know what's enough until you know what's more than enough, right? And then they're saying, which is, I think that's actually a really big revelation for most people, is that serotonin is actually not really a mood regulator. It's actually an energy regulator, a metabolic regulator. And if you look at the actual studies, a study that's accompanied in this article, they basically explain saying that serotonin actually lowers brain metabolism. And in general, just systemic, but also specifically brain metabolism. And I immediately remember that article that we discussed maybe like 5 years ago, yep, which said
Paul Andrews.
If the ATP levels in the brain drop by even 20%, you go into a murderous rage, mm-hmm, because it's kind of like all of your higher cognitive functions are gone because they cannot be supported at the lower energy production that's done with glycolysis or even with oxidative phosphorylation. Just not tiny, but like a 20% drop of ATP is sufficient to turn you into a homicidal maniac. Mm-hmm. So, and then I'm thinking, wow. And the fact that basically serotonin lowers brain metabolism, SSRI drugs raise serotonin. Every single mass murderer so far has been on at least one psychotropic drug. Most of them have been on SSRI.
And MK Ultra.
And nobody makes the connection?
And MK Ultra.
Oh, yes, of course, MK Ultra, yeah. Yeah, maybe they like they feed him with the SSRI drugs during the indoctrination period, and by the time they're released, they're like in a permanently upregulated serotonin. They probably are. Their baseline serotonin is really high, because that's the only way to commit these things, and often not even have a memory of them. Sirhan, who shot RFK, to this day claims that he has no recollection of the event, and he's been examined by multiple psychiatrists who believe that he's telling the truth.
Yeah.
That he basically doesn't even know the what he did.
I just had put something about that in my notes to read later, but there are a bunch of wacky things about that. And then Kamala Harris is the person that kept him in jail for kept like denying his like a reinvestigation of that case, apparently.
The Sirhan?
Yeah.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, she's a perfect puppet for the elite. You can tell by the way she talks. I mean, I don't want to get accused of misogynism.
Too late, how to pronounce it?
Misogynism.
Misogyny, yeah.
Yeah. But the woman is way over her head, and Biden's too, right? Just to make sure that I'm not picking only on women. But just the way she speaks, it looks like she's either reading it off of a teleprompter, just like Biden is, and then she never gives like a single when she tries to give a spontaneous answer, it usually is a disaster. So she only gives scripted answers. But just the way she carries herself is that you know that this is a person who is a, you know, we call them the yes man, right? That she follows orders, and basically there's no deviation from those orders. And simultaneously, she basically expects the same thing from her subordinates. So highly hierarchical person in terms of the power dynamic. And that is actually known to be controlled by serotonin. So she's probably on an SSRI as well. Let's hope she doesn't get a gun and start doing things in the White House.
This is a little bit off topic, but did you see that video of that Canadian political official that is like about to sit down? And then he gives the three sixes hand signal. This is like a Mason 666 symbol. He gives it like really obviously, and then he sits down. It's literally one of the craziest videos I've seen in a long time. It's like so blatant and brazen and in your face that he's doing this symbol, and then he sits down. And
Nobody bats an eyelash. The sheeple, like, oh, he was probably just, I don't know, gesturing to the cameras or something.
Well, it's funny if you type that guy's name in and like they're trying to say the titles of the articles were no, I forgot this guy's name, it starts with an L. It's like no person that starts with an L was not doing the white supremacy sign. Because this is like also, I mean,
this is the white supremacist sign, right?
Yeah. But it was specifically the other one where it's a 666.
Oh, like that down. Yeah.
And but they never offered up like a cogent explanation for what he was doing. But I think that's a classic Mason thing. Like this is a Mason thing. The hand and the thing.
The
like,
X, right?
Yeah. But there's a really funny video of LeBron James doing like double 666, and then we're both knocking over our mics. He's doing like the double 666, and then he does this, and then he does some like bow or whatever. Anyways.
So do you think LeBron is also in on it? Like he's part of the cabal as well? So at least part of like the...
I'm not an expert on Masonry, but I think they have all these groups that like they get to sports people, Hollywood, and music. And they even have groups for different age levels and things. And so, like, if you're an actor and they're like, hey, there's this super exclusive group and you can become a member of it. And then you escalate the ranks of this membership and then you do increasingly fucked up stuff to attain the different degrees, you know?
Right.
Like, based on what I've read, it seems extraordinarily plausible. Anyways.
I guess they found a way to get to everybody who is rich and famous and basically a celebrity. Those people will not be given the publicity that they're given unless it was also beneficial for the elite or they're somehow working for the elite.
Yeah. And then remember the Finders thing, that if you wanted to be in the Finders, that you'd offer up your children to them. The elite, there's old references in Mason text where one of the degrees is like you cut a head off a dead body or something. And so if you're Jared Leto and you cut a head off a dead body, what do you think you're going to go tell everybody about the Mason or something when you've done like horrible things that,
yeah, of course,
you're as dirty as everybody in the.
But that's the whole point. That's how they get you dirty. So they basically, they know your dirt and you don't, you know theirs. It's kind of like a mutually assured destruction. Nobody's willing to speak because, you know, they, well, first of all, most people won't even believe that story. If you get on TV and start telling these things that you've done, people say this guy's just disturbed, right? Or a girl. And if you start really, if people are starting to listen, then you basically fall into an elevator shaft onto some bullets and stab yourself in the head before you die.
Oh, man, this episode's getting dark. I'm just joking. Keep going.
You know what? I think it's a relative term. What do you mean dark? I mean, like, at this point, what's darker for this agonizing crap to continue or to end?
And
clearly, when it's ending, it's not going to be pretty. But isn't that what we all want? I mean, this can all go on for much longer.
I brought it up. The darkness is my fault. I'm just joking. I think it's important to talk about this stuff. Thus, why I talk about it. But yeah, man, that's we can move on. I could keep talking about this. Okay, so the serotonin stuff, they found out that it was elevated in depression, which is huge. And then talking about it being and modulating energy metabolism, which is super huge because everybody thinks it's a brain feel-good neurotransmitter.
Exactly. And they're saying, first of all, it's not. It's actually a mood destroyer. But even beyond that, its role is actually – this is not – the reason it's a mood destroyer because it's actually an energy regulator. So in just one article, they're tying essentially the entire etiology of depression – they're tying it immediately to energy metabolism. Mm-hmm. They're saying depression is basically nothing but souring up of the mood as a result of basically declining metabolism, especially in the brain.
And one of the huge things that Ray had offered in one of his newsletters as like that changed my mind about serotonin was I know we've talked about this 1,000 times, but it directly acting on the adrenals to increase cortisol. And then it directly
that's why saproheptadine is used to treat Cushing disease.
And then it directly acting on the pituitary to release prolactin. And I was like, if it does those, there's no way it can possibly be good because both of those things you want to limit. And so
those things are known by the doctors. But basically, when you raise that question, the answer is like, are you a doctor? No. Well, why are you asking this question? I'm like, you don't have to be a doctor to ask questions, right? If the question makes sense, why does it matter who is asking the question? I've had this discussion with other doctors who are actually friends, and they immediately get defensive, even though they will say, well, and then somebody else will ask the exact same question, but who is a doctor? And it's taken a lot more seriously, right? But if a layman like me asks it, the knee-jerk reaction is usually like, well, if it's coming from Georgie, it's not worth, discussing.
Well, you don't have a priestly lab coat on, so you can't be taken seriously,
unfortunately. That's true. I haven't been ordained as a medical priest, so therefore I am a, an infidel.
Yeah.
So the infidels burn. It doesn't matter especially if they make sense.
I agree. Okay, what, maybe the vitamin D deficiency can lead, cavities, was that a... What you tell me, which was another big one?
I think the cavity is a nice one because a lot of people are struggling with that and they're wondering, like, what can they do to improve tooth health? There was an article posted, I think it's also on the blog, that aspirin can actually, when placed directly into the cavity, can lead to stopping the cavity from exacerbating, potentially even regenerating some of the lost enamel and the actual bone of the tooth. And this one actually showed that, I guess this one would mimic taking vitamin D orally, because what they did is basically they had two groups. One group took just a measly 1,000 units of vitamin D3 for 6 months or 6 weeks, I forget. But basically, and then they took saliva from that group, and then they took saliva from another group who wasn't taking vitamin D, right? So imagine if you're only taking 1,000 units of vitamin D3, the levels in the saliva are not going to be that high. It's a really, really tiny dose. It's only two times higher than the RDA, which I think is like 400 IU per day, right? And we know that the 400 IU per day is basically the minimum that you need not to die, because it was based on a prisoner population. So 1,000 units is nothing. In fact, if you only take 1,000 units and you have a severe if you have a vitamin D deficiency or insufficiency, you will probably not going to end up in the normal range. You will not be able to raise it sufficiently. So the saliva from the people who took the vitamin D3, the low dose of 1,000 units daily – basically had a very strong cavity development suppressing effect on the teeth. And in some cases, basically, there was a they were showing that, there's even a hint of regeneration. And I thought, okay, so we know this vitamin K interacts with vitamin D for bone metabolism. We know that both of them are involved in osteocalcin, which is it's a protein secreted by the bone, and it's highly anabolic. It's highly anabolic both for muscles and for bones, and it's known to actually improve tooth development, especially underdeveloped teeth. And there's some older studies with it showing that it can potentially prevent cavities from developing even in people who maintain saliva with really low pH. So since vitamin K and D are synergistic, they both affect osteocalcin, the deposition of calcium into the bones instead of in the soft tissues. So I thought a combination of these two, that's how I end the post, would probably be like even more beneficial. And of course, I also say that 1,000 units of vitamin D3 is nothing. I would take at least 2,000 to 3,000 units a day, especially if there's not much sun exposure. I don't see why it would hurt to try putting some drops directly into the cavity of the tooth. I think that may have an even stronger effect.
Have you thought about adding olive oil to your vitamin D, like an option kind of similar to the vitamin K?
Yeah, we can do it, but it's not going to stand out in any way. I mean, the reason I didn't is because I wanted to make something that absorbs really well through the skin. And the ethanol SFA version, people are raving about it, especially when applied in the navel. Speaking of the navel, we confirmed through our testing of the steroids that it works insanely well of raising tissue levels of steroids. So basically one person was taking DHT. Dissolved in ethanol and the SFA esters, right? So they were putting 5 or 6 milligrams once a day into their navel. And basically when we tested their hair and the nail, the upper range for DHT for males in hair and nail was around 2.8 to 3 picograms per milligram. That person had a level of 31. So just 5 to 6, and keep in mind, not all of it absorbs, right? But it must be a pretty high absorption, because to get your levels an order of magnitude higher than the upper limit of the normal range, you must be achieving some pretty good absorption. So we're going to test some more things, we're going to test. Oh, we also confirmed that taking orally pregnenolone and DHEA works, that taking progesterone and DHEA, that all these things work. All the people who've been taking these, all the results came back with for elevated pregnenolone, if they've been taking anything with pregnenolone. Elevated DHEA, actually, even if they were taking a low-dose DHEA, so credit to Ray for saying that a dose of 5 to 6 milligrams daily of DHEA is probably enough for most people, even though it may not immediately raise your blood levels. In fact, some people have been complaining, saying like, oh, I've been taking 5 milligrams of DHEA for years and my blood levels haven't budged. Well, when we test actually in nail and hair, for those people that were taking even the 5 to 6 milligrams once daily, their levels were basically like right at the upper limit of the normal range.
Nice. That's doing some science here. Did you have a control for the belly button one or no?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, I mean, basically, there's another person who's taking what should I call it? They were taking DHT orally, and basically they're for the same formulation. They like sublingual, and basically their levels, even though they rose, they didn't rise nearly as much as the still above the normal range. But I think their levels were like 5, and the upper limit was like 3 something, or 2.8 or 3. So that person was taking sublingually, had the same dosage, 5 to 6 milligrams, had a level of 5, and the naval person had a level of like 31.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah. I didn't even forgot about this SHBG, sex hormone binding globulin, because I actually get a lot of these with the people I talk to, and so I've seen them all over the place. But why don't you tell us about this, and then we can talk about it more. So what's the deal with this article?
Oh, so they basically said that SHBG, apparently the levels decline very early on when actually your liver is starting to decline in health. Mm-hmm. And it's a good predictive biomarker for future severe liver disease years, if not even decades in advance. So if you go to the doctor and ask for a liver test, they're going to run the 3 enzymes, right? The ALT, AST, and the GGT, right? And if the results are normal, they'll be like, there's nothing wrong with your liver. They may also check albumin, right, which is actually a better test because it shows functionally how well the liver is working. While the ALT, AST, ASP, and the GGT, they're mostly acute injury biomarkers. They're not completely useless, but you could have. In fact, there's some people with even cirrhosis of the liver who have normal liver enzymes, however, very low albumin. Mm-hmm. In fact, most people with cirrhosis usually die from type of a kind of like a malnutrition, protein deficiency, yeah. Because their liver cannot synthesize things like globulin and albumin from the food that they're ingesting because the liver is really diseased. And basically, SHBG is another protein produced by the liver. And this study basically says that the levels of SHBG start to decline very early on in a process that's pathological for the liver. I also opined in my post that if you combine albumin and SHBG, you're probably going to have an even better biomarker because albumin is now known to be a very good predictor of all-cause mortality. Very old and very sick people have very low albumin, which is kind of expected because the liver function is probably in the drain due to low thyroid and other things. The proteins that are produced by the liver, they're usually a pretty good indication of overall liver function. So this study was on SHBG, but I have seen studies on albumin in cirrhotic people, also a good indication of liver health. But I don't think albumin and globulin are as predictive as SHBG that early on in the pathological process. Basically, once you start having low albumin, you're usually getting towards end-stage liver disease, a person going to need a transplant. Well, this study says SHBG starts to decline years before you get to that level. It's a good biomarker.
That's what I was going to say. That the albumin seems to never really be that off from 4 to 5 or so. It seems to always be in that, no matter how sick a person is. But, and I know everything bad pretty much decreases the SHBG, and I know that it can bind testosterone and estrogen, but the thing I see really often is high SHBG. And so that leads me to think that it's like defensive, or that maybe the person has high estrogen and the liver is trying to bind it through SHBG or something.
When the liver is well functioning. So if you have basically but towards the end stages of if the liver is constantly exposed to a lot of estrogen and basically the estrogen destroys the liver over time, eventually you're probably going to see low albumin and still high estrogen.
Yeah. Like similar to so ferritin is like an acute phase reactant and it's defensive, but then a lot of older women have really low ferritin. So their body is so tired or their liver is so under functioning, they can't even rally a response like a defensive response anymore with the lower ferritin, maybe a similar type of thing. Yeah.
I think somebody asked Ray about low ferritin. He said it's basically a good indication of low thyroid function.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But it's a liver produced protein. So if I think it's a more direct indication that the liver cannot basically synthesize what it needs to synthesize. Whether the reason is the liver is actually itself, there's like a local pathology in the liver, right? Or the liver is simply struggling because there's not enough thyroid, so the metabolic rate of the liver cells is not good enough to produce these things. It's a separate question, but overall, if the levels of the liver proteins circulating in the blood is low, chances are that the liver is not in a good state, and that usually goes hand in hand with thyroid.
Great stuff. Okay, let's do one more, then we'll talk about ID Labs. So maybe this low-dose niacinamide had a lot of interest?
Yeah, that also had a lot of interest, yep. And the human equivalent dose, I think, is very low. It's basically the equivalent of 2.5 milligrams per kilogram daily for a human. So right up, right in the range that Ray recommends. I think his recommendation for niacinamide has stayed remarkably consistent over the years. Whenever people ask him, he usually says 50 to 100 milligrams a couple of times daily. So right up there, basically, if you weigh 100 kilos, you'll be taking, according to that study, you should be taking about 250 milligrams of niacinamide in order to replicate, the dosage used in this protocol. It was really some remarkable pictures there if you look at the actual study. I mean, they basically lost 47% of their fat mass.
Wow.
And that's visceral fat.
So how did they lose if niacinamide is inhibiting the release of free fatty acids? How the heck are they losing weight?
Yeah, I know. I get this question all the time. Well, first of all, niacinamide doesn't inhibit baseline lipolysis. It only inhibits the excess lipolysis, which is triggered by things like, you know, very high adrenaline and cortisol. Also, niacinamide, by converting into NAD, basically allows the liver, because the process of glucuronidation and sulfation and the process of basically deactivating the free fatty acids, especially the PUFA ones, so you can excrete them through your urine, that process actually depends on energy. So but a good surrogate for the availability of energy is the NAD to the NADH ratio. So by raising the levels of NAD by taking niacinamide, you're basically helping the liver excrete a lot of that fat that's circulating in your bloodstream, and also suppressing, preventing that fat, these free fat acids from rising due to exercise or stress or some other activity that increases lipolysis. So you're helping your liver. Niacinamide is helping your liver be more energetic, which allows the liver to handle the fat more easily, on its own. And then also niacinamide, by preventing excessive lipolysis, which, by the way, can poison the liver, can destroy the free fatty acids. That's another way of indirectly helping the liver. And so you're basically excreting them over time. And of course, you know, probably another mechanism is just raising the metabolic rate. If the NAD to the NADH ratio rises, the mitochondrial ratio rises, that accelerates the flow of electrons through the Krebs cycle and the electrotransport chain. So it could be a combination of effects. It's a prominent metabolic one. I don't think niacinamide is an uncoupler, but it is a proenergetic substance, right? And it also improves liver health, directly and indirectly, and finally prevents the toxic effects of excessive lipolysis. So in other words, once you protect your organ, the liver, the major poison excretion organ, once you give it sufficient protection, it can handle the assaults a lot better. And I guess over time, your metabolic health improves because the liver is going to take care of all of these things that are floating around and are poisoning you or suppressing your thyroid gland, which happens to be mostly the PUFAs, but also some of the amino acids such as cysteine, methionine, and tryptophan, which the liver can also metabolize and excrete. But again, it needs energy for that.
Great stuff. Okay, so give us an update on IDLabs.
Oh, we finally released the steroid testing in hair. We can do both hair and nails. The problem is for the nails, there are very few published ranges from which we can extract, at least temporarily, like a reporting range, right? I mean, we can test it, but if I give you a value of, say, X for, let's say, your cortisol, cortisol, actually, we do have a range, but let's pick something more exotic, like, 17-hydroxyprogesterone.
Okay.
There isn't much information, if any, actually, for that specific steroid published of what we should expect to see as a normal range in people's hair and nails. So we can test the value, we can get the concentration, right, in both hair and nail, but if we don't know the ranges for nail, it's kind of meaningless. So we started with hair, and we have some nails from volunteers, so we're going to do the analysis on the nails of the volunteers. We're going to use that to come up with some ranges for nails. And then I'm going to announce it. It's there, but it's just not announced yet. And it's not enabled on the website to order. As far as hair, much more literature on the topic. We found published ranges for all of the 17 or 18 steroids that we can currently test. And those include in groups, basically. We call it the precursors, which is pregnenolone, progesterone, 17-hydroxypregnenolone, and 17-hydroxyprogesterone. Then we have something we call the corticoids. So it's cortisone, cortisol, aldosterone, the 11 deoxy varieties of each one of these, and the 21 deoxy varieties of each one of these. Then we have the androgens, we have the estrogens, and we also have the thyroid hormones. So it's a pretty neat set of steroid testing. And also, we found out, I'm not sure if you're aware, but it turns out that the ratios of these steroids is very indicative. There's a lot of literature published on the topic of the cortisol to the DHEA ratio and basically how it varies in pathology and health. And we found there are actually now several publications on the same ratio, but in actual hair or nail. And basically, just by looking at the ratios, even without normal ranges, you can actually tell, pretty reliably how well and how healthy a person is. For example, the cortisone to the cortisol ratio. Cortisone is the oxidized version of cortisol. So the cortisone to cortisol ratio is basically another surrogate biomarker of redox status. And if the ratio is low, which means cortisol dominates, you're basically under chronic stress and you're actually in reductive stress. And then if the cortisol to cortisol ratio is higher, which should be in normal people, because in younger people, healthier people, the ratio is at least 3. And in older and sicker people, the ratio is actually less than 1. Then there's also the cortisol to testosterone ratio in males. That ratio should be no higher than 10. Because, and then multiple publications on what happens if that ratio goes above 10. Well, specifically for males, the situation is seen in people with severe depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, diabetes, severe uncontrolled diabetes, obesity, morbidly obese, and basically chronically, critically ill people. So just by looking at these ratios, we can get a pretty reliable picture of how healthy the person is. And it's pretty nice because it's also a longer term picture. You can do the same thing with blood, but there isn't much. It's hard to say basically, like, because the ratios for many of these steroids can change in a matter of minutes in the blood, not so much in the in the nail, in the hair. So it's really basically a much more reliable way of assessing health than going and paying a lot for expensive blood tests, which actually don't tell you much unless you do once each week for like a couple of months, so you can get like a nice idea of how your curve, of what it actually looks like.
Amazing. I do coaching on Danny or patreon.com/DannyRoddy. And then I have been putting effort into the Substack just to aggregate all the information here. So if you click on an episode, you can see the episode actually being uploaded to specifically Substack. And then here it is on Spotify, and then I'll put YouTube links on there and stuff. Thank you for that, Georgie. Let's talk about a few more articles, and then we can get out of here. What else were you – what were you excited about?
Just pick whatever you want. I mean, since we haven't had a show in like 3 weeks, I think I posted quite a few of them.
Okay. What were the other ones? Talked about SHBG. Talked about serotonin. This one was good. The low dose endocrine disruptors induce learned helplessness.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Got it.
So I think this is pretty relevant and scary too, because basically the exposure was done at levels that basically are much lower than what an average person is exposed to during their daily activities. And basically they found out that, I think it was, can you scroll down just to see the quote, that basically they lead to passive coping strategies. And if you look at the definition of the passive coping strategies, it's basically learned helplessness, kind of basically like self-induced delusion that the stressor is not there. Convincing yourself that basically the stressor is good for you, basically convincing yourself that everything happens for a reason, that if things like this happen, then maybe you deserved it, maybe you're a bad person, that kind of stuff. These are all hallmarks of learned helplessness. You're basically trying to rationalize why these bad things that are happening to you are either not bad, or why you deserve them, or why basically it will all end in a very good way if you actually follow the rules and do what you're told and don't rock the boat. Again, the levels of exposure were about 5 times lower than what you would get if you drink, let's say, most of your water from a plastic bottle that can leach these chemicals into it. Now, there's some plastic types that are not that don't leach as much. But most of them, those are more expensive to make, of course, right? So most of the containers, plastic containers and plastic bags that are available to the general population are highly leachable or leaching. And basically, so I think the study has great relevance for everybody who, I don't know, lives in modern society. Probably not so much for people in rural areas, but for people living in the city, if you're suddenly, in a bad mood after drinking, your smoothie or your fruit juice, from a plastic bottle, maybe that's, that could be a very, very legitimate explanation. And the effects were they happened pretty fast too. I think just a few hours of exposure was sufficient to cause this.
My girlfriend got some like Mexican gum, and we were reading the ingredients, and there was something called BHT in the, it's like a super toxic chemical. we couldn't believe
hydrotoluene or something. It's basically it's used as an antioxidant. It's a cheaper chemical to use instead of vitamin E. Yeah. So back in the day, to this day, they actually use ascorbic acid, vitamin C, and vitamin E, but they use the tocopherol acetate, which is like the really cheap version, right? So that these are the typical go-to antioxidants for food production. But even that has become the greedy corporations are saying, no, we're spending too much money on antioxidants. We can do better, which means we can, you know, get something more toxic but cheaper into the foods. And they came up with BHT, and FDA approved it. It's allowed food ingredient in most countries around the world. It's not just the U.S.
I'm sure you saw it, but I think there's a photo of the soda shelf that was circulating in the 1980s, and it was just everything was glass. There was not a plastic bottle in sight, and so
of course,
I mean, I feel like that's such a theme of this show. You know, is that the environment sucks so bad, and I think a lot of people are like oblivious to that, like they don't realize that this environment is about. I mean, I'm sure it's going to get worse, but it's about as bad as it possibly could get. You know, like
passive coping strategies. It's right there. If you can't leave, or you know, if you're stuck somewhere, basically, what are you going to do? You're going to start convincing yourself that the environment around you is really not that bad. It's basically you're doing something wrong. Bad genes or whatever. Like all these diseases coming up of nowhere. It's most people will be conditioned not to think of the environment because, for one reason or another, they cannot leave. Or at least they think they cannot leave. And this will continue until, I guess, the health of the average person declines so much that basically everybody is on some kind of a drug, or you know, starts dying really young. And then that may actually get people thinking. And anything less than that, forget it.
Or
the normies love their prison. They love their chains. As long as you know the psychiatrist has refilled their prescription for an SSRI or whatever other poison they're ingesting, and you know, as long as they have their microwave warmed up TV dinner in a endocrine disruptor leaching plastic container, everything's fine. They don't care.
Things might change though if they get two life ending vaccines though. That would be another thing.
Right. Yeah. But again, what I'm trying to get to is that basically. Unless there's something traumatic happening in their lives, nothing else will move them.
Yeah. There was one other thing I had to say about this.
Now when people ask me political questions and like, what do you think is going to happen? So that I keep sending the Joker video.
the Joaquin Phoenix.
Thanks, Georgie. Thanks for telling me we'll eat each other.
the original Batman. Yeah, that's pretty accurate. Okay. What other articles here? I think we're running down the list. We talked niacinamide, niacin ratio, good for
bacterial infection? That's also a very good one. It's very easy to measure. And basically, unbeknownst to me, apparently the niacin, just the levels of niacin in the blood, which should be low. Because niacin is almost immediately converted to niacinamide and ultimately to NAD. So unless you're taking massive doses of niacin, apparently, like the levels of niacin in your blood should be very, very low. And specifically, the ratio of niacin to niacinamide should be close to zero. And if that ratio rises above one, then basically there's a very good chance that you're suffering from some kind of a bacterial infection, because a bacteria expresses an enzyme that can convert niacinamide back into niacin, and apparently mammals lack that enzyme completely. So and I started digging around and I found out that there was an old test for tuberculosis, which basically looked strictly at the niacin levels. I guess at the time they didn't know about niacinamide or didn't think it was relevant. But basically, like, they had a range published, and basically people with tuberculosis would have a niacinamide way, way above that range, which also, in light of the study, translates also to a high niacinamide to niacinamide ratio. And tuberculosis is a bacterial infection, severe one. So I think this is really good because it's most labs have those tests, and basically you can order them pretty cheaply over the counter, even without insurance. And it should be a very, very good indication. And I suspect it can also be used to diagnose kind of like a systemic low-grade bacterial infection that many people apparently struggle with, and potentially even Lyme disease, because I think Lyme disease is another kind of like a chronic low-grade infection that people struggle with, but it's very hard to detect on a regular test. Now, this test will not be specific for Lyme. All you'll tell is that this is some kind of an infection with a pathogen capable of metabolizing niacinamide back into niacin. So it could be, bacteria, or it could be, some other organism, including some of the parasitic ones, such as Plasmodium falciparum. I think that's the one that gets to your brain. Cats are carriers of that specific parasite. Another biomarker that it's pretty good because, oh, here's the other thing. Its usefulness is another important use of this test is that when you go to the hospital with some kind of a respiratory infection, they don't know if it's viral or bacterial. And I've talked to several doctors and said, so why not? What if the person is coughing up phlegm? Why can't you take some of that and culture it and see what bacteria is in there? They're saying because there'll be all kinds of bacteria, we don't know which one is the actually overgrowing and causing the infection. Mm-hmm. It may be not. People naturally have bacteria in their phlegm because it's getting there through your airways and it accumulates, right? And actually, that's probably one of the reasons people cough. It's to expel that. But they're saying like it's we don't know what to test for. It could be 1,000 bacteria in there. So if you go to a hospital or if you're home and you basically like you're struggling with some kind of an infection, and you want to know if it's bacterial or antiviral. In other words, whether you take antibiotics or not, that may be a good test to do, and it's a pretty cheap, quick, and dirty test that most labs in Western countries offer.
No, you know what? I just think I goofed something up. Okay, thanks for that. Sorry, I was having technical problems on my end. Okay, let's talk about one more because we're actually coming up on an hour here. Were there any other ones that had registered high on, or maybe was this ocular progesterone administration? May treat eye, brain, and mental illness.
That did register high, but more on the forum than on my Twitter feed. And I think it's really good because it basically they're proposing, and they've actually the group behind that study has developed several different eye drops containing progesterone. And they they use beta cyclodextrin, which is like a type of it's like a sugar like molecule. That they use to make the progesterone more soluble in water because it's actually a lipophilic steroid. Mm-hmm. And then they basically put the drops into the eyes of mice at the human equivalent dose of about, I think it was like, I don't know, what did they say, like 6 to 10 milligrams of progesterone per eye per day. And that thing basically, that treatment, I think, reversed a condition called retinitis pigmentosa. And it's basically that condition, I think, is simply the accumulation of lipofuscin into the retina. But then I said, okay, so retina is actually part of your central nervous system. If this thing can get to the retina, it can also get to the brain. So maybe, eye drops with progesterone can be a very good treatment, not only for a number of eye diseases, but also for a number of neurological diseases. And I also posted a study a couple of 2 months ago about putting niacinamide drops, a water solution of niacinamide, into the eye restored localized steroidogenesis and specifically androgen synthesis, which is very important for preventing dry eyes. That's a condition that many people are struggling with. And apparently, basically, like the niacinamide, by serving as a cofactor for NAD, that was sufficient to stimulate steroidogenesis in the eye and in the retina. So again, then I thought, okay, why not do the same thing but target the brain, right? Because if it gets to the retina, it means it's getting to the brain as well. So you can do a combination of both. There's nothing preventing. And by the way, niacinamide increases the solubility of steroids in water. So you can combine, you can actually use the niacinamide both as a hydrotrope, I think is the name, the increasing the affinity for water, and also an active ingredient itself. So I think the solution that they used, niacinamide solution they used in the previous study was a 2% solution. And this one, you can calculate how much progesterone you need, but basically make a 2% niacinamide solution first, then dump the progesterone, and then it keeps stirring and heating until it dissolves. And now you have a 2-in-1 punch supplement that's for both eye and brain health.
Yeah, but don't put Progest E in your eye, though. That would be
very bad. Several people asked me about that. I think they asked Pete as well, and he said that it may work, but it tends to be very irritating because of the vitamin E.
Yeah. I mean, that stuff's irritating to the back of my throat when I take it on my gums. And so that's why I put it on my legs, because it irritates the heck out of my throat.
Yeah, I believe you.
Okay. Other articles that you know of that we didn't get to?
Let me see.
Guys, thank you so much. Sincerely appreciate it. Subscribe to something, whether it's the Telegram or the Substack or something. Keep up with the show in some way. I try to – the even though I know Telegram is like owned by some WEF guy, I still have been updating that quite a bit. And I've been updating that when I've been not updating other things. So if you care to follow along, that's probably the best place to receive the content that I've been making.
I think the androgens and prostate disease and cancer, that's a pretty good one.
Oh, yeah.
For a number of reasons. First, they actually demonstrated that estrogens are inflammatory for the prostate. They also demonstrated that androgens are beneficial, and they also demonstrated that by deleting the androgen receptor, which is kind of what it's the really extreme version of giving an anti-androgen drug such as flutamide or dicalutamide, these are both androgen receptor antagonists, they actually greatly increased the localized inflammation in the prostate and started what looked like a cancerization process. So okay, even if you don't believe that DHT is a good guy, at the very least, this study directly demonstrates that the very drugs that are being given to prostate patients, especially people with benign BPH, benign prostate hyperplasia, those drugs themselves directly contribute to eventually giving these people prostate cancer. And after the cancer is already there, the anti-androgens actually greatly speed up its growth. An indirect and conversely, DHT being the most potent androgen, you expect it to have the exact opposite effects, but I'm not allowed to make that claim. When I brought this up again to friends, doctors, they said, well, where do you see this stated in the study? I said, it follows directly from the study. They said, no, it doesn't. So let's focus on the study then. Why would you be giving anti-androgens to people with prostate problems considering the study? They're saying, oh, Georgie, it's the dosage that matters. It's the dose that makes the poison. And a doctor, in his infinite wisdom and knowledge, knows the exact dosage they need to prescribe so that this does not happen. And I said, I've never met a doctor, including you guys, that actually even knew that given an anti-androgen damages the prostate. In fact, they very happily prescribe those drugs precisely because they believe that it's going to have the exact opposite effect. You'll be healthy. Silence.
Having known somebody that just had a radical prostatectomy, the funniest thing was asking about erections, and the doctor's like, oh yeah, you just got to take Cialis or Viagra. And it's like, those drugs are seriously dangerous. Like, it just, not that this is going to be shock to anybody, but it's like, we do something terrible to you that causes loss of function, and then you can get that function back by taking like a really dangerous, another dangerous drug. And then I can't imagine the quality of life seems like it's going down the tubes so quickly. And then this person, if they move too quick to their right, they're like piss their pants. It's like the stuff for prostate.
It causes lifetime incontinence. Yeah. The radical prostatectomy.
Yeah, it's literally insane. And it was because the doctor had scared this person into doing it because they said they would get cancer in the future. It's literally crazy.
Yeah, but of all the cancers that they can get, this one is probably like the most benign. Most people with prostate cancer, they don't die from the prostate cancer. They die from something else.
Yeah. Well, tell that to this doctor.
I've given up. I mean, I'm honest. I have several people who were college mates, and they went to medical school, and we keep arguing about these things. And then it's just as Ray said, if a person's salary depends on him not understanding something, he'll never understand it.
Well, that's an Upton St. Clair quote, I think. Or if Ray had said
Okay. It's not Pete's. Okay, he's just repeating. Okay. I mean, they're very cordial, but you can tell – they have a limit, and once you start making too much sense, they kind of freak out and they're like, shit, are we killing people on purpose here? Like, does that mean they, at some point the patients are going to have a wake-up moment and maybe chase us around the hospital with guns?
Well, I heard this secondhand, but our buddy Kyle Mamounis, he was saying that if you want to be a doctor, it selects for the type of person that will not ask questions or
a psychopath.
Like go along with the flow or like a type A behavior, like a person that's going to, like, if you're doing a doctor residency, it's not going to serve you to always contradict what the doctor is doing.
They will throw you out.
Yeah,
I mean, exactly. They will throw you out of medical school. If you keep asking questions being a contrarian, all this thing about curiosity and thinking outside of the box and whatnot, that's such horseshit. It's not even funny.
But in fact,
when I was working as a consultant, we did some work for very large Fortune 500 companies. when we were testing their computer systems, but some of the files that we looked inside is, you'd be amazed what kind of drills the HR department comes up with in Fortune 500 companies to actually weed out and identify the disruptive, the out-of-the-box thinkers, so they can fire them. Yeah. I'm serious. They actually have these drills where basically they'll have these seminars, and they'll actually try to find out who is this person who is, you know, creative and out-of-the-box thinker but keeps to themselves and doesn't really rock the boat. So they can, even if they don't rock the boat, they preventatively get rid of them.
Yeah. That's like a Palantir type of thing, right? Like that they have all this information on you.
But this is pervasive. This is, I mean, every we did this assessment for maybe four or five different Fortune 500 companies. Every single one of them had a program like this. Mm-hmm. It differently structured, but ultimately the goal was basically like find out who those thought leaders or whatever you want to call them are. I hate that term, but that's what they use, right? And then essentially blackmail them into somehow, you know, signing off, like relinquishing even more control over the freedom that they already don't have much to start with. And if the company senses that this person is inmalleable and it's not going to budge and they're not going to play ball, they get rid of them without cause. Basically, they'll say, I don't know. I mean, actually, most states in the U.S. are at will employment. They don't even have to give a reason. They just get rid of you.
Yeah, not surprising, and just especially true with the medical profession. Okay, wrapping it up. Any last thoughts?
I don't know. I mean, I think the last week has been extremely interesting. We'll see what happens. I don't know what to think anymore. Whether it will be a good thing that the collapse is kind of coming, or did you see the Putin speeches?
No.
Oh, there's if you go to Russia Today, they have like several articles from the last couple of days where basically Putin is saying, The unipolar world actually has already ended. We're never going back because basically too many things have changed irreversibly, irrevocably, and the world, the monopolar world is over. And he's saying that basically there will be a change of elite. He specifically used that word. So I wonder what he means by that. Would there be like, does he expect some kind of like a popular revolt to happen in many Western countries? But he's basically saying he confirms just what Ray was been talking all about about all these years, is that the whole show is run by a small clique of elite people who pull the strings. And he's saying these people are delusional because they apparently believe they can still go back to the old days when they were controlling the entire world. He's saying that part is over. And he's also saying that they have lost, the elite has lost a significant amount of power, and he expects them to be a change of elite over the next couple of years.
Interesting.
That's one of the articles. There's another one where he specifically talks about the change of the elite. If you go to the front page and do Control F for elite, it should show up.
Russians, I think this is the same one. I just clicked on. Oh, no.
There we go. It's a different story. Yeah. Yeah. So Putin starts to sound a lot like Pete. He's saying the exact same things. Change of elite is could be kind of sinister too. Like he didn't say, you know, removal of the elite. He said simply change. So it could be just, you know, the oldies die, like Kissinger and I don't know, and Soros and their sons and whoever else replaced them, and they're just a psychopathic.
Yeah, well, yeah, wasn't Kissinger not super happy with what was going on in the Ukraine? Like
I think that was the biggest giveaway that basically the elite kind of messed up. They fucked up bad, and now they're saying make peace because this is going to destroy us. But for some reason, the administration, the U.S. administration in general, the Western world is kind of like continuing with the war. I guess it's a fighting between the lobbying groups that are selling weapons and making a lot of money out of the war. And then Kissinger, who kind of is kind of more like a strategic thinker, and saying, you just don't understand, this thing will destroy all of our pillars of power, which mostly depend on the dollar being the reserve currency and being used for trading oil. Both things are being undermined by this war. So make peace now while we still have a chance.
There was a crazy video that came out like a few months ago, and I kind of didn't pay attention to it. But it was the guy that runs the Rockefeller Foundation, and he explicitly said, in 6 months, there will be like devastating food shortages. And he predicted it like a month ago or 2 months ago.
It's on Zero Hedge. Another big banker said that the collapse is already happening.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It was just, I guess the thing that caught me was he predicted within like, he was like, yeah, 6 months or something. It was something very specific. And I was like, oh, geez, that sounds really bad. But that would line up with things getting really bad towards the end of the year, as anybody with a brain could probably project. Like, things are getting worse every month.
Well, I mean, by worse, so here's the thing. It's the economic collapse is not necessarily bad, because what's collapsing right now is all of this fakeness that has been around for so many years, and they call them the zombie companies. It's companies that basically, they cannot repay their debts, and the only way they can stay afloat is by borrowing more. They roll over their debts at an ever-increasingly lower interest rate. So those are the companies that basically are producing effectively nothing, and they're essentially making money off of percentage points on interest rate, or just rolling over their debt on a lower interest rate new loan, right? So I don't have a problem with these companies going away. Yeah, sure, some people will be without a job, but these companies are a bane, like a toxic burden on society, on a country, and they're really draining the life out of everything because for those companies to exist, this money printing has to continue. And ultimately, the money printing destroys everything for everybody. So, there may be some pain here and there. But in the long run, it's better. Well, let's see. There's a very good chance that the Fed may freak out and start printing money again, just before the election. Because let's face it, every president that is in power will do everything possible to get reelected. And one of the things they will do is try to improve the economy, at least around election time, so that they, swing the scales in their favor.
If that Rockefeller Foundation guy was right, or what he said was accurate, and people can't get food, normal food items, bread, milk, and stuff by the end of the year, and then those CBDCs really do come out in like February 2023, like Powell said, that would be a perfect matchup, because I'm totally speculating, but how would they get people to buy into it? Like they would be desperate. They'd be desperate for food. Or if you give people CBDC bucks or digital dollars to buy food and stuff, and they can't get it at the market, or there's rationing, that would really make sense that people would be happy that they had instituted the digital dollars, because they'd be starving or couldn't get basic items.
But there's other issues here. Let's say they introduce the digital dollar and people are desperate. They accept it because that's their lifeline, right? There's no food. There'll be food shortages. So even if you give them the digital dollars, it looks like there may not be enough food to go around for everybody. So that's not going to solve that problem. I just saw an article. I forgot it was on Zero Hedge or Russia Today, which basically said that the current energy consumption, the way that the world is structured, can only be maintained by either nuclear power or fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. If we switch, and the push is huge, and I think they're going to actually end up doing that, to switch over green energy very, very fast over the next 3 to 5 years, the current energy consumption is completely unsustainable. It's impossible to maintain, and it's going to decline by about 90%. Declining energy consumption means declining in food production. So it doesn't matter whether you have digital currency or even gold, there's not going to be enough food to go around to feed everybody. So we'll see.
But what you're saying is a lot of people are going to die if they do that, which is, we know exactly what they would want to do.
Yeah, but I'm also thinking, I don't know if this is because the elite is dumb or they have something in plan, actually plan for that. Because if a mass dying starts out of food shortages, then the whole situation gets out of control. So either they believe that somehow it's not going to happen. Part of me says they're dumb, because they really messed up on Ukraine. They miscalculated Putin's abilities and how willing China and Russia were willing to work together. So completely miscalculated. And many times over, right? Just predicting the 9/11 attacks. Yeah, predicting the inside job called 9/11, right? Then predicting the Arab Spring uprisings. They couldn't, right? Many, like the Afghanistan fiasco, all of these things, basically up until like the day of the withdrawal, the CIA was coming up with statements saying like, oh no, it will take like years for the Afghan army to collapse. We've trained them well. We've given them so many weapons. 24 hours, 24 hours later, like basically everything is in chaos.
I forgot about that.
The U.S. military is leaving. Yeah. So we'll see. I think that if it gets to the point of mass dying, I think it's game over for the elite too. I don't think this can be controlled. They're just, even with all the technology they have at their disposal, people have not been corralled yet into like a digital prison where they can fully control them and basically kind of say like, yep, 9 out of 10 of you are going to die. And that's just the way it is. Right. Right now, if that word gets out on the street and people start to realize it, I don't think the elite can control the situation. It will be mayhem.
You've been more right than I have, so I defer to you for these issues. But okay, with that, with these that dark topic of starvation in the near, the very near future.
I don't think it's a dark topic. This has been – look, it's like many – just like the zombie companies, many people living in the Western world are zombies themselves. So the only thing that can shake a zombie out of its, I don't know, semi-slumber semi-alive state is some kind of a shock. This is not going to be easy. It's not going to be pleasant. But the alternative is much worse. The alternative is full digital prison for everybody, where basically you and I are fully the property of the corporate government complex, and they can do whatever they want with us. I will take my chances with food shortages and riots and mayhem and social collapse compared to going to the digital prison.
Well, that's one of these articles on technocracy.news. They were saying that – we kind of talked about this last time, I think – that Americans have such strong normalcy bias that it's like almost impossible for many people to fathom that bread would not be at the store or milk would not be at the store. And so the author of one of these articles was like, Americans have no clue what's around the corner.
Most Western Europeans too. I mean, even though Western Europe did see two world wars, right? Most of them were fought there. After a couple of generations, all of this is forgotten. Unfortunately, reading about war and enduring war are two completely different things. And, you can read a story that's horrifying, right? But unless it really hits you personally, it remains just a story. You forget about it like 10 minutes later.
Yeah, okay, we talked about this last time. Okay, Georgi Dinkov, idealabsdc.com. You can follow Georgi on twitter.com/heydit. You can follow me at twitter.com/DannyRoddy. You can t.me/DannyRoddy. I do coaching on patreon.com/DannyRoddy. And then you can go to idealabsdc.com, which is Georgie's boutique supplement company. Okay, Georgie, any final words here?
I think freedom is coming. It's over. The shit show, the monkey show, the clown show is over. Let's see what replaces it.
Georgie, you can cuss on this show. I encourage it.
Is what?
Oh, you can curse others. I encourage the cursing.
Yeah. Well, is shit show and clown show curse words, really? I thought it's like when you're saying the F word or stuff like that.
Same. I think they're the same thing.
Okay. Actually, yeah, when the proverbial bull crap hits the fan, let's use like that. That's what we used in one of the episodes with Ray.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah. I'm hopeful, actually, because I'm finally seeing signs that this abomination, which has continued for far too long, is starting to crumble. It won't be pleasant. It won't be pretty. But there's, at the end of the tunnel, that's the only tunnel that leads to the light.
I'm excited for doing a live episode with Ray and you being on Skype. And that's the only thing I'm hopeful for in the future, is that Ray come back to Mexico and us doing a live show. That's like the only thing I'm looking forward to.
If things get really rough, I think he will leave. I mean, I think the only thing keeping him here is Kenogen, right? He said basically it will be very hard to run from Mexico, and that's about it. I don't think he has any – I mean, he can run his newsletter technique. If even there is internet, he can run it from Mexico just as fine. Most of his newsletter now I think is electronic, right?
Yeah. Well, we'll catch up with him next week, and so stay tuned to that. Guys, thank you. We have an amazing audience. People have been asking me all week where our new episode was, so we finally got around to recording it. And thank you, Georgie, being my partner in crime and continuously 84 times getting together with me and doing these episodes.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Yes. Really appreciate it.
Let's hit 100 before the collapse happens.
That'd be nice. That's a good goal to do. Yeah, I'd like that a lot. Okay, guys, have a safe weekend. We'll talk to you guys soon next week with Ray Pete. Peace out. Bye, guys.